5. The lazy question, in which you discover the question that will make you more useful to those you manage while working less hard, and you decide that being lazy is a good thing after all. You're so helpful. You're a good person, and you're always doing your very best to let your people thrive. You want to add value and be useful. You like to feel that you're contributing. However, there's being helpful, and then there's being helpful, as in stepping in and taking over. And way too often, you get suckered into doing the latter. Then everyone, you, the person you're helping, the organization, pays a price for your attempted helpfulness. Your good intentions often end up contributing to a relentless cycle of exhaustion, frustration, and, ironically, reduced impact. Edgar Schein has untangled the paradox of being helpful in his excellent book, Helping. At its crux is the insight that when you offer to help someone, you one-up yourself. You raise your status, and you lower hers, whether you mean to or not. This idea seems counterintuitive, I know, because so often our desire to help comes from genuine caring. But the insight rings true when you put yourself in the shoes of the person who is being offered help. When you think back to times when help has been thrust upon you, you'll probably notice a curious mixture of reactions that include resistance, frustration, disempowerment, and annoyance. So what's going on? And how can you temper your approach so that more often you are helpful in a way that actually helps? A useful starting point happens to be a triangle. The New Seven Dwarfs and the Karpman Drama Triangle. Transactional analysis, TA, is the slightly out-of-fashion therapeutic model that has given us the labels of parent-child and adult-adult. It's intriguing, but almost impossible to apply directly in organizations. It involves too much therapy speak. The drama triangle, a practical interpretation of TA developed by Stephen Karpman, is one way to make TA practical and useful. The drama triangle starts by assuming that, at least some of the time, we're playing less than fantastic versions of ourselves with most of the people with whom we interact. If you've ever found yourself playing one of the seven dysfunctional dwarfs, sulky, moany, shouty, crabby, martyr-y, touchy, and petulant, even when you know you should know better, you get the point. When this happens, Karpman says, we're bouncing around between three archetypal roles: victim, persecutor, and rescuer, each one as unhelpful and dysfunctional as the other. As you read the descriptions of each role below, do two things. Bring to mind someone who is particularly adept at each role, and bring to mind the circumstances in which you most commonly play each role. Victim. The core belief? My life is so hard. My life is so unfair. Poor me. The dynamic? It's not my fault. It's theirs. The benefits of playing the role. You have no responsibility for fixing anything. You get to complain. You attract rescuers. The price paid for playing the role? You have no sense of being able to change anything. Any change is outside your control. You're known to be ineffective, and no one likes a whiner. Stuck is, I feel stuck because I have no power and no influence. I feel useless. Persecutor. The core belief. I'm surrounded by fools, idiots, or just people less good than me. The dynamic. It's not my fault, it's yours. The benefits of playing the role. You feel superior and have a sense of power and control. The price paid for playing the role. You end up being responsible for everything. you create victims. You're known as a micromanager. People do the minimum for you and no more. And no one likes a bully. Stuck is, I feel stuck because I don't trust anyone. I feel alone. Rescuer. The core belief, don't fight, don't worry, let me jump in and take it on and fix it. The dynamic, it's my fault/responsibility, not yours. The benefits of playing the role, you feel morally superior. You believe you're indispensable. The price paid for playing the role, people reject your help. You create victims and perpetuate the drama triangle. And no one likes a meddler. Stuck is, I feel stuck because my rescuing doesn't work. I feel burdened. These three labels aren't descriptions of who you are. They're descriptions of how you're behaving in a given situation. No one is inherently a victim or a persecutor or a rescuer. They are roles we end up playing when we've been triggered and, in that state, find a less than effective version of ourselves playing out. All the world's a stage. We all play all of these roles all the time. Often we'll cycle through all of the roles in a single exchange with someone, lurching from victim to rescuer to persecutor and back again. To make the point, here's a made-up conversation I might recently have had with a client after I gave a speech. Me, shouty, this room setup is all wrong. I sent through my demands of how I want this. How hard is it just to set up the room as requested? And donuts? Stop feeding people donuts! And the session starts in 15 minutes! Persecutor. Client, whiny. I sent the setup sheet to the logistics people, but it's really hard to get them to respond, and I've had to organize this whole conference by myself without any support, and... Victim. Me. Resigned. Look, don't worry about it. I'll just rearrange the room by myself and get the tech set up, and I'll cook eggs for everyone. Rescuer. Client. Frustrated. This is just typical of prima donna speakers like you. We're paying you too much already, and you have to have everything just so, and then you take over any time you're not happy. Persecutor. Me. Whiny. I'm just trying to make sure my session's a good one. No one understands how hard it is to get a room set up the right way, and then as soon as you try, everyone hates you. Victim. And so it goes. And it can happen even faster than that. Think of the most annoying person on your team right now, the one who's giving you difficulty even as we speak. Did you notice that in a flash you jumped to persecutor? They make me so mad. Victim. It's not fair. Why can't I just get them onto someone else's team? And rescuer. I'll just keep trying to do their work for them until they get up to speed. All at once. The minute we begin to think we have all the answers, we forget the questions. Madeleine L'Engle. Your go-to role. That said, we tend to have a favorite role that we default to most of the time. If you're like the majority of the people I've taught, when asked to identify which of these roles you play most often, you'll choose the rescuer. And even if rescuer is not your default role, I'm betting you recognize it well enough. When we're in rescuer mode, we're constantly leaping in to solve problems, jumping in to offer advice, taking over responsibilities that others should rightfully keep for themselves. We do it with good intentions. We're just trying to help, to add value as managers. But you can already see the price that's being paid by both sides. You're exhausted and they're irritated. You're limiting opportunities for growth and for expanding the potential of those you're working with. More provocatively, you might be coming to understand that rescuers create victims, though we want to believe that it's the other way around, which is also true, but not only true. Are you doomed? Yes, You're doomed. Seeing the pattern of the drama triangle is a strong first step in breaking the working too hard pattern of the time-crunched manager. Once you understand the triggers, you can start to reshape the habit. The bad news is that you are, in fact, destined to keep falling into the drama triangle for the rest of your life. The good news is that you'll get better and better at recognizing it and breaking the pattern faster and more often. Samuel Beckett put it best. Go on failing. Go on. Only next time, try to fail better. You'll fail better by recognizing more quickly that you're in the drama triangle and by asking the lazy question, how can I help, to pull yourself out of the triangle faster. The lazy question, how can I help? The power of how can I help is twofold. First, you're forcing your colleague to make a direct and clear request. That may be useful to him. He might not be entirely sure why he started this conversation with you. Sure, he knows he wants something, but until you asked the question, he didn't know that he wasn't exactly clear on what he wanted. Unless he was, in which case the question is useful for you because you can now decide whether you want to honor the request. Second, and possibly even more valuably, it stops you from thinking that you know how best to help and leaping into action. That's the classic rescuer behavior. Like, and what else, this question is a self-management tool to keep you curious and keep you lazy. Too much of your day is spent doing things you think people want you to do. Sometimes you're completely off base, but that's not the worst of it, because that gets sorted out relatively quickly. More dangerous is when you're only slightly wrong. That's when you find yourself kind of doing what they want, but not enough so it's really useful, and not so wrong that someone tells you to stop. Be blunt. The more direct version of how can I help is, what do you want from me? If how can I help is James Bond in a tuxedo, then what do you want from me is Bond in bust out of the baddie's evil lair mode. It strips the conversation down to understanding the essential exchange. What do you want? What do I want? And now, what shall we do about that? But be careful. You can likely guess that how "what do you want from me" lands will depend in no small part on the tone of voice in which it's asked. To connect it to the drama triangle, if you're in persecutor mode, it might come across as aggressive, in victim mode, as whiny, and in rescuer mode, as smothering. A way to soften this question, as with all questions, is to use the phrase "out of curiosity." What that does is shift the question from perhaps coming across as an inquisition to being a more noble inquiry. Other phrases that can have a similar softening effect on the question being asked are "just so I know," or "to help me understand better," or even "to make sure that I'm clear." The anxiety of asking how can I help and how to manage it. The biggest worry people have about asking how can I help is the range of potential answers. I need you to do this horrible/unreasonable/impossible task. I'd like you to have the difficult conversation I'm avoiding. Can you please give me all of your budget? Here's one extra thing for your already towering pile of responsibilities. What's essential to realize is that regardless of the answer you receive, you have a range of responses available to you. Yes is one, of course. You can always say yes. But you don't have to say yes, and your sense of obligation to say yes is the source of your anxiety. No, I can't do that, is another option. Having the courage to say no is one of the ways you stop being so helpful. I can't do that, but I could do, insert your counteroffer, is a nice middle ground. Don't just give them a no, give them some other choices. And finally, you can just buy yourself some time. Let me think about that. I'm not sure. I'll need to check a few things out. Avoid the rescuer sucker punch with this new habit. It's hard enough when someone starts telling you what's going on to resist moving into advice-giving, solution-providing mode. It feels nearly impossible when someone asks you a question that's a direct appeal for your advice. How do I, or what do you think I should do about? Seductive and dangerous, this is the cheddar on the mousetrap, the light on the mosquito zapper, the block of chocolate in the cupboard. Before you know what's happening, you're giving an answer. Now, there's a time and a place for giving advice. The goal here isn't to avoid ever providing an answer, but it is to get better at having people find their own answers. So here's your new habit. When this happens, someone gives you a call, drops by your cubicle, shouts out across the office, sends you a text message, and asks, "How do I?" Insert query most likely to sucker you in. Instead of giving her the answer, I will say, "That's a great question. I've got some ideas which I'll share with you. But before I do, what are your first thoughts?" And when she answers, which she will, you'll nod your head and be engaged and interested. And when she finishes, say, "That's terrific. What else could you do?" More nodding, more being interested. Then say, "This is all good. Is there anything else you could try here?" And then, and only then, you can add your own idea into the mix if you wish. And of course, if the conversation is going well, keep asking, "And what else?" until she has run out of ideas. Build your new habit here. When this happens, ... Write out the moment, the person, and perhaps the feelings that are your trigger. The trigger here is how much you want to help. So, what sets you off? It's likely when someone asks, "How do I?" or "Could you?" or "What's the way to?" Or perhaps it's just when someone comes into your office and tells you about a situation and the perfect solution pops immediately into your mind. Or when that happens in a team meeting. Or when you think to yourself, "It's faster to do this myself," even though you're unclear on what the "this" really is. In short, it's every time you get that urge to jump in, help out, and volunteer. And the real insult here, to your time, effort, and good intentions, is that the recipients may not even want or need what you're about to give them. Instead of ... write out the old habit you want to stop doing. Be specific. The old habit you're breaking is you're jumping into helpful action mode. You're giving the solution, you're providing the answer, you're adding something to your to-do list. You're assuming you know what the request is, even though the request hasn't been clearly made. In short, you're taking responsibility. I will ... Describe your new habit. It's likely to be some version of, "I will ask them, how can I help?" You're seeking clarity by asking, "How can I help?" Or you're being even blunter and asking, "What do you want from me?" Watch it work. Watch the short videos at thecoachinghabit.com/videos to deepen your learning and help turn insight into action. How to be more helpful rather than helpful. Michael unpacks the work of Edgar Schein to help deepen our understanding of why often our best attempts to be helpful generate resistance and end in failure. The Drama Triangle Recap. If learning about the Drama Triangle struck a chord with you, then these videos will help you learn more and share the wisdom with others. From the Box of Crayons Lab. In the "And What Else?" chapter, we mentioned a study that found that the average time a doctor waited to interrupt his or her patients was a mere 18 seconds. But our Box of Crayons researcher has found some other studies that show us that not all doctors lack conversational graces. Lindsay uncovered a study about different approaches to beginning a conversation with a patient. Some doctors used a more general inquiry, such as, "How can I help?" Others used more confirmatory questions, such as, "I understand you're having some sinus problems today." With the more general inquiries, patients gave longer explanations of their concerns and mentioned more discrete and specific symptoms, so they were more likely to be homing in on the real problem. As an added bonus, the doctors who asked the more general questions also received higher evaluation scores from patients. When you ask the lazy question or another more general opening question, the science tells us you're not only more effective, but you're also more respected. Question Masterclass Part 6. Actually listen to the answer. You ask one of the 7 essential questions, and then you move into black belt active listening mode, nodding your head like a well-sprung bobblehead doll, making small grunting sounds of encouragement, maintaining eye contact at all costs. Yet rattling around in your head is a riot of distraction. Perhaps you're worrying about what question you should ask next. Perhaps you're thinking about how to get this whole conversation wrapped up as fast as possible. Perhaps you're wondering whether it's your turn to cook tonight and whether you have enough garlic in the cupboard or if perhaps you should pick some up on the way home. In any case, the wheel is spinning, but the hamster is dead. No one seems to know where this phrase comes from, but whoever invented it, I salute you. One of the most compelling things you can do after asking a question is to genuinely listen to the answer. Stay curious, my friend. Here's your new habit. When this happens, after I've asked a question, instead of going through the motions of looking like I'm actively listening, I will actually listen. And when I get distracted, which I will, I'll come back and start listening again.